Let's do it again. Press the button off and on, please. Leave it alone. If you cannot... This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly doing the wonderful program here of the Easter Seminar for 2006 in campus. And we are having the Christ Arises in Us Seminar. We've done Lecture 1, Who and What Do We Call Christ? And Lecture 2, Christ is in Me, How Do I Let the Christ Out? And now we're ready for Lecture 3, The Man Must Die So God Can Arise. Man must die so God can arise. Sounds pretty threatening, doesn't it? Sounds like a pretty threatening concept, but a very fascinating concept. Think about it. Think about what it means that the man must die so God can arise. We all realize how thoughts are things and how a child has childish thoughts or the thoughts of a child yet not mature, and a man or an adult being has adult thoughts. And that doesn't mean adult thoughts, it just means mature thoughts that have been matured over the years and over his and her experiences in life. That's kind of interesting. But the man must die so God can arise. What does that mean? What does it mean when we say the man must die? Well, we had a perfect example of that in the life of Jesus. Jesus was the man. Jesus pretended he was human. He pretended he was living with and as his human counterparts, his mother and his fathers and sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmother and grandfather. He probably had loads of people because the Jewish families did. Well, Jesus also had many people around him who believed in him and listened to him, his disciples, his followers. He was a great teacher. He was a great Messiah. He was a great person to present the teachings that he had in mind. And he presented them. And when people came to him, like the woman who had the issue of blood, she touched his garment, and Jesus immediately knew it. Not because he had some special camera showing her touching him, but he knew that someone came to him with a great need. He knew that someone came to him with a great need. He knew that someone came to him with a great need. When the centurion came to Jesus and said, "Would you heal my servant?" And Jesus instantly said, "I shall come immediately." And when Peter's mother died, and he said, "Raise her," and he did. When Lazarus was raised from the dead, he did. When all these things were done, his mother said, "Make wine for the wedding," he did. You see, he was a sensitive person who was sensitive to the needs of his time and his community and the people who were around him. He was acting like a human man. And everybody worshipped him like a human man. They said, "Oh, you can do miracles. You can touch us and we can be healed." And he said, "No, it's done unto you according to your belief. I put on a good show and you believe it, so you think that it's me that's doing the healing, but it's really you that's doing the healing. It's really you that has spoken your word and made your claim upon this." "Oh, no, Jesus, it's you, it's you, it's you." And Jesus went on with his ministry for some 3 years, and finally he was fed up. And he said to his disciples, "I must go so the Comforter can come." Now, the disciples had no idea what he was saying. They had no idea. And then he said, "I must die." Die? Now, that's another story. And he said, "I must die. I must leave you." And then, as he told Peter, he says, "You're going to deny me, you know, your boss, your boss, your president, your doctor, your head of the business here, your guru. You're going to deny me 3 times before the morning cock crows, you know." And Peter said, "My God, no." He said, I'm true to you. I'm your number one man. I'm going to stand by you with all my strength and power and being." And Jesus said, you're human. You're human. I don't think unkindly for you for doing this, but I know you're going to do this. And I want you to be aware so that you're not going to be so hurt. You know that I understand. And when Lazarus, or no, but who was it, taking the money? Judas. When Judas came to him and said what he did, Jesus said, do whatever you must do and do it quickly. He knew that was part of the game, that was part of the show. He knew the entire drama that was going on in his life, and he knew that that was part of his leaving program. It was just part of the program. And so Judas didn't need the money. He was what? What role did he play with Jesus' group of men?
Was he the tax collector?
He was the money keeper. Yeah, he was the treasurer. He kept the money. And he didn't have to have someone give him money. He could have taken any money he had because they had plenty. They had sufficient. Whatever was needed was there. And he could have used it. But he wanted to test Jesus to see if he really was going to be the king of the Jews. And if he was going to be the king of the Jews, then he was going to take down the Romans. And he's going to take down the Jewish community that was trying to get after him. And so when they came with their sword and they lopped off the ear, who did that? Peter lopped off the ear, remember? And he says, no, put that back. No fooling around. And he says, we're not here for the sword. And you see, they didn't understand. And what I'm trying to tell you is the human aspects of the spiritual career of Jesus the man had to go. The man had to go. The man must die so God can come. And Jesus was always saying, it's the Father in me who doeth the works. It's the Father in me. And it's I as the Father who doeth these works. And he said, I am God. He said, ye are God. We are all God. But nobody believed it because he was acting like a man. He was acting like human. Now, if you ever have a great teacher, and that great teacher acts like a human being, be careful. That great teacher might be in disguise. That great teacher might be somebody else that you don't even know about, some divine, spiritually illumined being, God, that is just playing a role for a time to give you a chance to catch your breath. Now, I'm not trying to point pictures to me. I don't need to do that. I know who I am. Do you know who you are? And you cannot see who I am, dot, dot, dot. You cannot see a spiritually illumined master, whomever that may be, unless you are a spiritually illumined master. And you're not going to be a spiritually illumined master so long as you claim that somebody else is God and you are not. You understand that? And this is what the disciples did. They claimed that Jesus could do it and they could not. This is why he had to go. And when he went, they still wouldn't let him go. And when he went, what's the first thing they did? They thought of disbanding. You know? This happens in so many organizations. They thought of ending the organization, closing up the organization, disbanding it. And it's quite interesting how that works, isn't it? Disbanding an organization. Well, hey, it's cool. Because nobody really believed what they were taught. They only worshiped the man who taught or the woman who taught. Because there are many fabulous, charismatic leaders who have come down the pike in America, at least, I'm sure all around the world, and who have had followers of great numbers. And I would just offer one suggestion. Look at Billy Graham. Billy Graham is charismatic, unimaginable. He is a spiritual leader, unimaginable. He is an illumined being, unimaginable. His philosophy and teaching may be slightly different from ours, but that's not the point. He believes in himself. And others believe in him. When he stands up to speak, his audience finds him to be most acceptable, most wonderful. And that's great. Now, I only say to you, what is he teaching? And I'm not asking you to make a judgment here. But what is he teaching? Is what he is teaching, is it going to stand up, and will anyone be able to carry the ball when he is gone? Will anyone, his son, his family, his followers, his students, his backup people who he's trained over the years, are any one of them going to be a drawing card like Willie is? And the answer is no. They'll be their own drawing card. Now, if they can take what they have learned from him and apply it and teach what they have learned, they will be great. Do you know why Paul was so significant as a leader who had been Saul, remember, and his transition to Paul? Do you know why he was so great as a leader of the Christian faith? Because where he taught, nobody had ever known Jesus. He had never known Jesus. And he had to listen to the intuitive light within him. He had to listen to the spark within him of his own divinity. He had to listen to God in him as him speaking out. And he had no books, no references, no stories. And none of the teachings of Paul teach any of the things that Jesus did, because Paul didn't know about them. Paul had no reference to what Jesus did, except that Jesus was a spiritually illumined being. And somehow he got that story across in the most marvelous way. Now, you see, who was there who could follow Paul? Who was there who could follow Jesus? Not Peter. Peter tried to follow Jesus. Peter tried to be Jesus' number one person, but he didn't make it because Peter didn't listen to the philosophy that Jesus taught. He worshiped the man, as did all the disciples. This is not in any way putting them down, because had we been there, and we were, if we had been aware that we were followers of the Master, we would have been the same way. We would have been in awe in his presence, as those are who are in Billy Graham's presence, or Robert Schuller's presence, or the Pope. You know, the Pope doesn't get to be the Pope because he's just an ordinary man. He gets to be the Pope because he has been an outstanding spiritual leader in his faith, in his field, in his organization. And the people, they feel that he has what the organization needs at this point in time when they make him as the Pope. And the Pope is supposed to be what?
Infallible.
He's number two man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Under Jesus. Jesus is number one, the Pope is number two. Or maybe under Peter. It all depends on how you're looking at what they're talking about. But you see, and as Sylvia points out here so sickeningly, he's infallible. Can you imagine anyone being infallible? Now, hey, if the Catholic community were to look at the Pope and say, the Pope is infallible and I believe that, then what would that mean? The Pope is God. The Pope is absolutely divine, the divine master. And if the Pope is the divine master, wow, I sure would like to be close to him. I'd like to be at his feet and learn. I would like to be taught by him the principles of right action, goodness, and life, and truth, you know? Now, you don't want to be at my feet, or Billy Graham's feet, or the Pope's feet, or anybody's feet. You want to be at your own feet. This is but the message that Jesus gave according to the Bible that we read. He gave this message in saying, it is done unto you according to your belief. And so, you see, Jesus had to go. See, the man had to go so that God could arise. And Jesus said, God is within you. God is the allness in you. God is who you are. God is your reality. God is the only being that you are. And you see, when we realize that, what happens? Then we stop worshiping the outer, and we start worshiping the inner, which is almost just as bad. But when you worship at least the inner, you're worshiping the divine in you. And you're listening to your own inner self. You're listening to the intuition. You're listening to the inner light, the inner voice, the inner being in you that is revealing all things to you. As with a child, its body shell bursts to reveal the hidden splendor of divinity within. So, this is how the Christ was. The Christ was growing up. We can't say that. Jesus was growing up. And the Christ in Jesus burst to reveal itself. And it tried to burst out a number of times, remember? It tried to burst out when he was born, you know, and when he was 12, and when he was 33, and through his ministry, it tried to burst out, but it wouldn't burst out. You know why it wouldn't burst out? Because the people wanted him to do things. Because his ministry had been at that point and through that time mostly a ministry of morals and right action and community service and doing according to the laws of Moses. You following? But then he came to the point and he said many times, "It is done unto you according to your belief. It's done unto you, according to your belief." And he wanted to get the people to believe that it was done unto them according to their belief. He wanted the people to get the people to believe that it wasn't something outside of themselves that they should worship. That it wasn't the money changers in the courtyard of the temple that were doing bad things. It wasn't anything that was going on that was good or bad. It was that rather than looking to the outer, look to the inner. Rather than chasing after all these philosophical concepts that came along. And, you know, why do you think in the time of Jesus the Jews were very adamant against other, like the Samaritans, you know, other peoples who had other beliefs? Why do you think they were very adamant against the Billy Grahams and the Popes and the Robert Schulers and whoever else? You know, why do you think they were very adamant against them? They were adamant against them because they were not teaching what they were teaching. You see? And they chased them away. They killed them. They took them to court. They got them out of town. If the community was mostly Jewish, they did not want the people to be messed up with this other teaching. This other teaching might be a teaching that says, you are divine, you are wonderful, you are good, and God is not only in the tabernacle, is not only in the ark, is not only there. God is everywhere. And truly, this is what the Old Testament teaches from time to time, but it gets lost in the morass of the magical music of the words of the Psalms and songs and the other beautiful books of the Bible. And they are beautiful. They are human and delightful. They are uplifting and rewarding. But they want to bring us back. I say to you, the man must die so God can arise. I say to you, you have to leave the human beside. Leave the human aside. And when you leave the human aside, then what takes place? What takes place when you leave? That means no more movies. No more television. That means no radio. That means no involvement in the world outside of you. That means only going within to your inner self, the divine in you, and go into your closet and pray to your Father who heareth in secret and seeth in secret, and he will reward you openly. Go into that inner self. But we've got to know what's going on in the world. We've got to be participants in the business and the commerce of the world and the politics of the world. We've got to know where people are in need so we can go and help them. We've got to know where the world is not behaving itself so we can put them under control. You see, this is what we've been taught. This is what we have been told. And I told you the story of the little boy who came into his mother and said, "Mother, I hate you." And he started throwing things around. He threw his toys around. He put up a tantrum that just would be the winner of all tantrums. And his mother, being a spiritual illumined being, looked at him and said, "Son, something's troubling you. Can I help? What seems to be the matter?" And the boy says, You know, he threw more stuff around, tipped over the table and knocked the lamp down, broke the bulb, and really made a mess. And any normal mother would have whacked the daylights out of him. But no, this illumined mother said to her son, "Son, you're being troubled. Come, let's talk about it. Let's figure out what it is, because that's not you. You are a gentle, loving, sensitive, caring child. I'm always so proud of you. Let me know what I can do to help you." And then she goes away even. And he's not going to mess up anything while she's gone, because he doesn't get any credit for it then, you know. So he waits until she comes back, and he throws up a half-hearted tantrum. And a few days later, he throws up another half-hearted tantrum. And his mother says, "Now, have you figured out what's troubling you? Have you figured out what seems to be the problem?" She must let him tell her. Because if she tells him, then, of course, that's another argument. But when he tells her, then she says, "Okay. Now, so every time you go outside and you get on your bike, Johnny comes over and says, 'Get off that bike, I'm riding it.' And you're angry and you're hurt. It's your bike." And Johnny says, "This is bike for me to ride now. You clean it up and I want to ride it this afternoon and have it out here in front at 1 o'clock right after my lunch." And the kid is scared and frightened and mad, you know, angry, ready to kill this other kid. And he comes in the house and takes it out on his mother in the house. And finally, he tells his mother, "Well, Johnny's been forcing me to let him have my bike. And whenever I come out the door, he takes my bike and wants to ride it." I said, "Well, let's go take care of that." "Mom, I got to do that myself." "No, no, come on. Let's go take care of him." So she goes with him. And they go talk to Johnny. And then Johnny is a little nicer when Mom is there. And then they say, "Come on, let's go inside and let's talk to your mommy." So they go in and talk to Johnny's mother. And Johnny's mother is sitting there crying her heart out. And they ask, "What's the problem?" And she says, "Well, my brother died, and my sister died, and my mother died in an accident. That all three died, and I just am beside myself." And so she's crying, and she's unhappy. And so Johnny is naturally unhappy too, but he doesn't know what he can do. He's frustrated. There's nobody who takes him into their confidence and says, "Johnny, sometimes people die, and life goes on, and we do things that are right and good." But she didn't say that because she was so frustrated herself. And so her neighbor friend says, "Well, Mildred, I know what you're going through. I had a death in the family last year too, and for a moment it was very terrifying. And then I realized that nothing happens by chance, and that this was their choice somehow, we don't understand why, that they're going to go and leave this life and move on to another wonderful life. And we have to let them have that privilege. Like when a little child puts his hand on a hot stove after you told him, 'Don't put your hand on this hot stove, you'll hurt yourself. You've got to do it,' you know." And they want to die, and they want to go to this next dimension. Maybe it's not what they want to find when they're there, but that's their business. And so Johnny is hearing this, and Johnny says, "I mean, everything happens in life by a purpose?" And the mother says, "Yes." And Mildred is very surprised. She doesn't know what to think, and then all of a sudden she thinks, yeah. They were having trouble with this and that and the other thing in their life, and they were not facing up to it, and they were just getting more and more angry about it, just like me getting angry about their death. And really, it has nothing to do with me, except that I miss them living way off in that part of the country that I never see them anyhow. But I miss them because they're my family. And so then Johnny's hearing all this, and Johnny is mellowing out. And he says to the boy with the bike, he says, "I'm sorry I was so mean to you, but I didn't know how to be. Mother was so unhappy, and I didn't know how, and I didn't know how." Yeah, and the boy with the bike said, hey, "You come borrow my bike anytime you want. You come borrow my bike." And the two mothers looked at the children, and they said to each other, "You come talk to me whenever you have a problem, and we'll work it out together." "So I got to be able to come to you too." "Oh, yes, of course." But you see, the frustration, the anger, the meanness was affecting both families in a terrible way. And only through a little bit of love and caring and enlightenment, not being responsive immediately to an angry child and tell them how terrible they are, but say, hey, I'm always proud of you. Okay. So, the child has burst out of the shell when the child no longer is angry. The child has burst out of the shell when the child understands a little bit and says, hey, you can ride my bike anytime you want. You just come on. I'm in your ballpark. I'm in your yard. I love you. And the two mothers, they got to love each other too. But can you see? It seems so distant from the Christ picture. But it's exactly what Jesus said to the woman at the well when she said that when he told her that she was having a relationship with every man in town and the women didn't like that. And she said, shup, 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 shup. You know, and how did you know that, you know? And then when the men came to stone her, he said, let you who is without sin cast the first stone. I mean, he was a psychologist and a psychiatrist. He was a par excellence in every way of looking at life. And he could work with every one of them and blend them into a harmonious group of people. He could work with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. He could work with the Samaritans. He could work with people from other religions and other faiths. And his own disciples came up to him and said, Jesus, these guys are teaching, and saying they're teaching what you're teaching. And Jesus said, are they teaching what I'm teaching? Yes, they are. Well then, he who is against me is against me. But he who is for me is for me. So, why should I be concerned? Let him who is for me be for me. How does the phrase go?
If they are not against me, they are for me.
That's even better. If they're not against me, they're for me. So, that's quite nice, isn't it? Isn't that a nice phrase?
Yes. Yeah.
If they're not against me, they're for me. Hey, nobody's against anybody in this life, are they?
No.
Is anybody against you?
No.
Is anybody against what you want to accomplish and do in life?
No.
Is anybody against what direction you want to go?
No.
Well, then it's about time we wake up, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And time we wake up to realize that everybody loves us. Everybody's harmonious with us. Everybody is synchronized with us. And it's wonderful. You know, it's so fantastic. As a child, its body shell bursts to reveal the hidden splendor of divinity within as it grows older and older and develops and responds to life. But when a child lives only in the community and worries about the community and is put down by his peers rather than uplifted, then, hey, that's not too cool, is it? Not too cool at all. The child is divine, and as it reveals itself, it reveals its divinity ever so much more, unlimited. The child is divine, and as it reveals itself, it reveals its divinity ever so much more, unlimited. How do we work with the child? How do we work with ourselves to express our divinity and be unlimited? How do we get to that point? How do we open the door in our consciousness to be the divine being that we are? How do you do that? Have you ever wondered about how you do that? Have you ever wondered about how you can be divine? How you can be spiritually illumined? How you can be the expression of all that is good and beautiful and pure and fantastic? Have you ever wondered? I'm sure you have. Well, you can only do it in one way. And Jesus told us a little phrase for that. Does anyone click onto it? You must become
as
a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven. I give you enough lead words, it brings you in, but that's all right. You must become as a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, what is it about a little child that makes him so eligible to be in the kingdom of heaven? A little child judges not. A little child loves everybody and everything. A little child does not know anything about their country. A little child only knows to give its toys to everybody else who comes along and says, would you like to play with this? Would you like to play with this? You know? Because I like to play with that. Oh, yeah, I like it very much. But would you like to play with it? Sure. Can I take it home? Sure. You know? A little child is so free and open with everything that it has. And the neighbor children come over and they tell bad stories about their parents. And the little child says, oh, if my parents did something like that, I wouldn't say anything about that, you know. You know, in all innocence, in all gentleness, because it did not excite the little boy to hear this bad tale. And he say, hey, I wouldn't say that, my gosh, you know. If my parents ever did something like that, I would never tell the world. My goodness. Happily, my parents don't do that. My parents are good parents. My parents are wonderful parents. My parents, and pretty soon the other children, they recognize that telling anything bad about their parents is like giving themselves a black eye. And so they're not going to do that. And so they're going to start making up stories about their parents, how wonderful their parents are, and how their parents feed the birds on the back window, and they don't even have a back window, and how they put the feeder out there, and how they put the sugar feeder out there. They don't even have a sugar feeder. And how, oh, I tell you, the kids make up the most delightful stories, and that's great. That's great. Because when you say your parents have a feeder on the back window, and they have a sugar feeder back there on the back window, you can be sure, as you repeat this story, pretty soon it's going to be there. And you're not going to know how it got there. A neighbor is going to come over and say, I got two feeders and I only want one because I have birds all around the house. You know, would you like one of them? Yes, thank you. And another neighbor comes over and says, I have this gallon jug that I've been using as a sugar feeder for the birds. But they have been coming to the house in just torrents, and the bees and birds and everything else. And I tell you, even the hummingbirds are coming. Would you like to have that feeder? I just don't want to throw it out because it works so good and it's nice. But boy, oh boy, you got five kids and I got two. And I'm sure that your five kids would enjoy looking. Oh, yes, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And here, just for being so nice and taking it from me, here is 20 pounds of sugar. Well, thank you very much. And how do you mix this? Well, Sylvia, how do you mix it?
1 cup to 4 cups.
One cup of sugar to 4 cups of water. Yeah, 4 cups of sugar to 1 cup of water. My, oh my, those birds would be high. Well, 1 cup of sugar to 4 cups of water. And so, next thing you know, hanging outside their back door is a big old plank going out there, nailed onto the roof. And then hanging down from that, maybe about 4 feet from the house, is this big old sugar feeder. And the birds are there. All the birds in the world are coming there. And they decide, well, let's have some big holes for the big birds and some small holes for the small birds and some teensy-weensy holes for the bees, because we like to satisfy the bees, too. But the bees don't care. They go in the big holes, the middle holes, and the small holes as well. They don't care. But, you see, you put a cause in motion. Now, how did the bird feeders all of a sudden get going? How come one bird feeder only has bread on it? That's for the bigger birds. And how come now the kids are getting so excited? Well, what do bluebirds eat? What do robins eat? What do these canaries and sparrows, and what do those things eat? Well, they each have a different type of food. Well, let's get those foods out there for the different feeders. And mother said, my gosh, this is getting me an expensive proposition here. But hey, and the kids say, Mom, you said it's an expensive proposition? Oh, hey, Mom. I really wasn't doing anything with my money, my allowance. Can I put some of my allowance on that? And Mom, when I go help the neighbor and I sweep the walk for them, they give me 50 cents or a dollar or two. Can I put that toward the bird feeder? Why, sure, let's have a box here. And this box is for the bird feeder money. And pretty soon, the box is full of money for the birds. For the birds. But it's wonderful. Now you say, Herb, why are you telling this story? I'm telling this story because when you put a cause in motion, you don't know how it's going to work out. When you put a cause in motion with love, you don't know what it's going to do to your family, how it's going to bind your family together as a cohesive whole, and how everybody in your family is going to partake of this wonderful adventure, and how things are going to happen. I know. And I want to tell you why I know. And I want to tell you, you got every reason to believe in me. And I'm going to tell it to you right to your faces right now. I am Mr. Candle. And I go to the homes of boys and girls all over the world every night as I say goodnight to them. And I sit on their bedside, shining on their faces and saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. And they tell me everything. Yes. And you say, well, Herb, you're not really Mr. Candle. You are just Mr. Candle on a tape that you put on the internet and you send out to people. And you make up all that stuff. How about that? How about that? Are you ready to try that again? Anything the mind of man can conceive of and believe in, he can experience. Anything I tell you, I am taking from the scrapbook of my heart, of my life, of the adventures that I have. What do you think I'm doing all day long? While I'm sitting at my desk writing or while I'm at my bed sleeping. What do you think I'm doing? Do you think that I'm not out lollygagging and having a ball?
Of course.
Being a Mr. Candle and being a wonderful counselor and lover for people all over the world who have their little problems and all they need is just a little extra gentle touch, you know? Yeah. You know, when people call you up on the phone and they say, who are you? And I say, well, I'm Herb Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing. But you sound like God who talks on the dial of healing prayer. I'm the same guy. Or sometimes I don't say that. I say, no, we hire him special. Well, you know, you play the game and they say, oh, my, what does he charge? And he charges belief. If you believe in him, he's there for you. And if you believe in him, he tells you, you're there for you too. Mm-hmm. Fantastic, yeah? How about that? Mm-hmm. Okay, so man is in corollary to the child, making way for God. It's Christ's self. Corollary is defined as something that naturally follows. Man is in corollary to the child. Man naturally follows the child, making way for God. It's Christ's self. You know, you can talk to a lot of people, and you can have a lot of people explain to you what's going on in their world. And as these people explain to you what's going on in their world, if you find them eager to get something for nothing, you find a very selfish being. Because a lot of people are looking at getting something for nothing. They want to find money in the street, you know. I was driving down the freeway, coming back from visiting my sister in the hospital. And that was up at that Los Angeles there, City of Industry. And as I was driving along, all of a sudden, the traffic stopped. Totally. Didn't move an inch. And I thought, okay, let's see what's happening here. And so I looked out the window. I happened to have a clear speed lane next to me that was clear. And the police cars are going, ting, 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 with all their whistles and sirens blowing. And they caught up to one thing that they wanted to catch up to, but not the people. Somebody had robbed a bank, and so as they were fleeing the police, to create pandemonium, they threw money out the window. And so all the traffic stopped. And people were out picking up money and picking up money and picking up money from the street. And, of course, One of the police cars, by the motorcycle cop with a bullhorn on his motorcycle, he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, that money was stolen from the bank. Please bring it here. We appreciate your cooperation." And it was delightful. I was sitting in my car away from the pickup zone, but watching. It was just a little bit of a slope there. It was underneath some big bridges that were crossing over, but it was just charming. And people by the dozen, had, especially the children, had gotten out of their cars and picked up all the money they could, and they stuffed it in their shirt, and stuffed it in their shirt, and stuffed it in their shirt, because they had no pockets to carry it in, you know. And you think, oh, they're going to run away with it. Well, they went to the policeman on the motorcycle and said, "Here it is." And he said, "Yeah, now what do I do?" He had no place to put it. Fortunately, a patrol car came along after that, and they opened the door, and they threw it in the back seat of the patrol car. So these people who would always wish for found money and always wish for, the, you know, I went home and I told my wife, I picked up $30,000 and I gave it to the police. "You gave it to, you didn't stick anything in your pocket?" "It's not mine, sweetheart." But you see, honesty is so beautiful. And it was so beautiful that day. I told you about it, but I don't think you recall it in this light, but I told you about it. They were picking up money and picking up money and picking up money, and they didn't stop until they had it all picked up that they found. But of course, the guys did it further along, too, and they, you know, got away, but they forgot the police could come up from the other side. And the police did and got a hold of them. And by the time the police got a hold of them, they didn't have any money left in the car. But they had the evidence that these guys did it, and they put them in jail. But it was such a beautiful thing to see these people, and especially the children, picking up the money, walking on this crowded freeway, which was stopped dead still, and crawling under cars and getting the money and bringing it out and sticking in their shirt, you know, because, as I say, they had no place else to carry it. And taking it over to the police car and shaking out their shirt and shaking out the money, and the policeman saying, thank you, you are a good citizen, thank you, you know, and saying good things to them, which is really wise. But now you see, think about that. Think about them. Man is in corollary to the child, making way for God. It's Christ's self. Man follows up how it has been raised as a child. Now, you can tell by what type of things people watch on television how they've been raised as a child. Had they been allowed to watch these violent things on television as a child? Had they been allowed to watch violent actions, the Las Vegas shows on television? I mean, you can get virtually everything on the internet. Have they been allowed to do this? Have they been allowed to watch pornographic material on the internet or on the television? It's very interesting. There's an article in Business Week, and it is an argument between the Europeans and the Americans. And the Americans are saying they do not agree that there should be a permitted pornographic.com on the internet. It should not be allowed. And the Germans and the French, they say, boy, you Americans are certainly prudish. You know, you're certainly not very open to life the way it is, you know. And I thought to myself, how interesting. How interesting. Here the Americans are the adults of the British community out of which they were born. And they have taken this excellent quality of not approving of pornographic things in the world, and on the internet at least, because they said it could just get truly out of hand, as it is already. And the European others, they were saying, you know, they're being prudish. It just shows your ancestors, you know, coming over on the Mayflower, are very prudish about everything. You know? I mean, that's pushing it back pretty far, hundreds of years. But anyhow, I found that just a charming response to man growing up from child. Our children were trained to have values and to have a life that is filled with meaningful ways of living. They're trained to be Christians. They're trained to be spiritually directed people, spiritually directed children. And now, as the country loses its original foundation and takes on the foundation of being what the new peoples are who are coming into the country with their religions and their teachings and their ways, which are different from the early ones that were the founding fathers of this country, the country is becoming much more broad in its acceptation of things that are not really beneficial to the total country, as I understand it. Now, I'm not saying we should do it or not do it. I'm only saying, what are we going to do with the baby boomers? Remember the baby boomers? Well, the baby boomers are now running the country. What kind of a life did they have as they were being raised by their parents who were rather indiscriminate in many ways? You remember? The flower children and so forth. Now, what are we going to do? Well, these people are making some pretty wonderful, value-oriented people, because they saw how misusing the principle as they were growing up was not beneficial to them. How using drugs indiscriminately was not beneficial to them. You see, they realized having values as a Christian or as a, even, not even, that's not a proper word to say there, as the Buddhists or the Hindus or as the Jews or as the whatever nations, whatever religions on the world you want to say, all of them have values. But some of them differ a little bit from the values of the American society. And so these are things that concern us. Now, what does this have to do with the Christ consciousness in us? Well, the Christ consciousness in us does not need morals. The Christ consciousness in us does not need ethics. The Christ consciousness in us does not need to have any of these things, because the Christ consciousness in us is our original purity and integrity, and it has absolutely no interest in anything which is going to undermine the purity of our society. You understand me? Nothing is going to undermine the purity of the mind of the people here who believe that God is good and that they follow their inner guidance, their intuitive guidance, and they're right. Now, I was talking to a Supreme Court judge several times over the past couple of weeks, and a remarkable man. He's a very open New Thought spirit, but very definite on the law. He knows the law, and that's why he has that job, because he knows what he's doing. So he said about several things relative to the church, how the law was not beneficial to the church, because the law allowed the church to think that it was above the law, and that it could operate contrary to the rules and the right action of the community and the law. You say, how can that be? Well, by misusing the nonprofit status of their churches. That some people made their home into a church and their business into a nonprofit status, and then they didn't pay their taxes. Now, that's okay, except that they believed they were doing the right thing. Were they doing the right thing? Now, you know they weren't, and you know that they knew they weren't. You knew that they had found stolen money and that they were keeping it against all good judgment. Now, where do we stand on that? Where do we stand? If we have a bona fide church that has had services or does have from time to time or whatever, beautiful. But if we have a church and we receive money to that church and we take it as a tax-exempt money and the church gives no service to its members or the community, then the church has no reason to exist. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Now, so you see, the church itself sometimes falls short of the mark when it thinks that it's immune to some of these things that the rest of the world is responsible to. And that's not true. We complain about the rich people having tax breaks that allow them to become richer. Well, they can afford to have the lobbyists in Congress, and they can afford to make donations to the congressmen and their funds to have the congressmen support this sort of thing. Well, you say, well, that's not fair to the general population. Oh, yes, it is fair, totally. Because if the general population did not agree to that sort of thing, all the general population would have to do is of one accord say, every wealthy being or organization in the world keeps pure, honest books and is honest with the government. Now, that's not a bad thing to say, is it? And you see, if everyone were to say that, what would happen? Every organization in America, or on Earth, if you wish, would keep honest books, not the double bookkeeping bit, and would also pay their proper share of taxes to the government without feeling unhappy. I tell people I'd love to pay $1 million in taxes every year. Because if I had $1 million, just imagine what I would be having to keep. I would be having many millions of dollars to keep. And how wonderful that is. Now, Ingeborg, how can you sleep with your knitting in your hand? You are an amazing lady, and you don't even miss a stitch, do you? So go for it. You're wonderful. We're doing just fine. Life is so beautiful, and the world is so wonderful, and everything we are saying is so great. Man represents humanity. Man is defined as being capable of abstract thinking and reasoning and articulate speech. Interesting. Here we have it printed, what we were saying earlier. Man represents humanity. Man is defined as being capable of abstract thinking, reasoning, and articulate speech. Ellen, this is your examination question par excellence right now. God has neither... Now, can you finish that statement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Logic or reason.
Logic or reason. See, it was there.
Yeah,
now, what is the statement again?
God has neither logic nor reason.
Mm-hmm. So God has neither logic nor reason. Now, here we say, man represents humanity, and man is defined as being capable of abstract thinking and reasoning and articulate speech. That's from the dictionary. Now, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Now, man is not representing God when man is using abstract thinking. Now, what is it that makes man not using God when man uses abstract thinking? Let's say man wants to create a chip with a trigger byte on it. Or let's say, what's the next step from a trigger byte? a gigabyte, yeah.
A trillion bytes.
What's that?
A trillion bytes.
A trillion bytes? No, that's too easy. It has to be some stupid word, you know, like a quark bite, you know. So what is it that is going to allow man to move up to that level? Do you think any logic or reasoning is going to, abstract or real, is that it's going to put him on the road to accomplishing that? Do you think so? It cannot, because it is not God. When you think those thoughts, it is the divine in you thinking those thoughts unlimited, without any preconceived idea of what is right or what is wrong. You follow me?
Yeah.
So, you see, when that is taking place, when logic and reason, and when we say here, abstract thinking, abstract reasoning and articulate speech. Dorothea, what does the word articulate speech mean to you? Don't think.
Well described.
I'm sorry?
Well described.
Well described?
Yes, the situation is articulate when it's well
described. Thank you for the sentence. That makes sense, yeah. Articulate speech is speech that is well described. All right, now, how do you describe anything? Now, you see, now be real careful on this here. Describe Ellen to me.
Oh, she's dynamic.
Go on, describe her. That's fine. That's good, but describe her. Is that the word, the only word you have for her?
Oh, my God.
She's dynamic, she's forceful, she's powerful, she's... You see, we can't spend a lot of time while you're thinking of things. You should snap, 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 because you're a sharp lady. You're in those jigsaw puzzles like crazy. And so, you see, what is it that articulate speech is doing? Articulate speech is describing and giving a parameter to things. And whenever you give a parameter to something, you are making it limited, and you are not making it unlimited. So every time we use articulate speech, we are giving something a parameter, or we are giving something a limitation. And we want to be beyond all limitations and all parameters. We want to be beyond all articulation. We want to be beyond all, what kind of reasoning? Abstract reasoning. Abstract or logical reason. We want to be beyond that, because that will not put the great amount of bytes on a little chip. That will not open the universe to you. That will not. The story of the Big Bang Theory is such a beautiful story, so wonderfully told, it's going to give Alice in Wonderland a run for its money. And it belongs in the same genre of Alice in Wonderland, and that's good. That's good. However, it is true. And Alice in Wonderland is true. And all of the little people are true. Ellen, what did I tell you to do?
To take my word and having the...
Speak up a little bit so I can pick you up here nicely.
Having the elves is coming in and just expand on being creative.
Now, you see, Ellen was very selfish there. I said to Ellen, your daughter Mariella is a very busy girl with five children and a big house and all these things to do, and she loves to do it, but it keeps her busy. So, Ellen, you create five lovely little elves to go in and do the work for her. And they do the work when no one's around. And so when everybody comes down for breakfast, the house is spick and span. The floors are polished within an inch of their life. Everything is glorious. The tables are all set. And the thing is, as soon as the children walk out the door and go to school, the elves come back and clean up the place and make everything nice. And one of them even sits and has a cup of coffee with Mariella, you know. And they have a wonderful time. And then one evening, their daughter, the littlest girl, Melissa, came in before the last elf got out of the house. And she saw the elf. She said, Mom, what are you doing with an elf here? And her mother said, oh, nothing. Doesn't everyone have an elf around? And it made for a wonderful story, but not only a story, but a wonderful idea. Now, could Ellen be a blessing to her daughter, seeing her surrounded by elves who love to help her take care of the work she has to do at her home? Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice, Dorothea?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that takes imagination. What's that, please?
We could use them, too.
Ha! Now, you see, that's why you're never going to have them.
Oh, we have some.
No. You're never going to have them if you only think for yourself. When you are thinking of surrounding others with these things, then it happens to you. But when you are thinking, well, we could use them, too. I think I'll keep a couple at home here, you know. But be careful. That type of philosophy is a philosophy of I wanted to say loser, but I don't want to put that on you. But it's a philosophy of a very hard situation. And I mean it very seriously. Very seriously. If you allow yourself, anytime you see someone else have some good, to say, oh boy, I love that too, you know. Somebody else wins the sweepstakes. I wish I would win the sweepstakes, you know. Or somebody else gets a brand new car delivered to their door and nobody knows how. And boy, I wish somebody would do that for me. You see, that consciousness puts you out of the ballpark for receiving it. That consciousness puts you out of the Christ consciousness of living in the infinite abundance of what is yours. You do not ever want anything that is somebody else's. You may admire it, and you say, well, I'm so happy for you in all sincerity that you got it. But the moment you start thinking that you should have it too, then you're in trouble. Ha, ha, ho, ho. The man must die so God can arise. Man represents humanity. Man is defined as being capable of abstract thinking and reasoning and articulate speech. And I think that makes it pretty clear. We will have lecture 4 next when we get together here. I am the totality of Christ now. And be ready for some more fun. Know that I love you very much and that I see everything good and beautiful in your life and in your world now and forevermore.
Thank you.
I love you, I love you, I love you.